think it's comical. Fa la la, fa la la. A nature often does contrive. Fa la la la. That every boy and every gal that's born into the world alive is either a little liberal or else a little conservative. Fa la la, fa la la, is either a little liberal or else a little conservative. Fa la la.
Indeed. It's been a very political week, so I thought I'd start us off with a political song. That was the Centuries song from Iolanthe. And this is, of course, Radio Derb, your infallible source for news and commentary. And these are the dulcet tones of your operatically genial host, John Derbyshire. Well, it was certainly an interesting week. I spent Tuesday evening sitting around with a bunch of National Review staffers watching the returns. We were cheerful enough, but not really dancing in the aisles. Our disappointments were your disappointments. Nevada, Colorado, Illinois, Delaware. The Illinois governor's race is still officially undecided, but that's disappointing in itself. Sharon Angle was the biggest disappointment for me. She was in New York a few weeks ago and stopped off here at Buckley Towers to give us some face time. Charming, sensible, personable lady with good conservative policies. Ah, well. And then Christine O'Donnell. I spent the early part of Tuesday evening hoping that Christine would rack up some decent numbers so that I could say to the room, "It looks like Christine O'Donnell is holding her own." But, alas, the opportunity was not vouchsafed to me. We did get Rand Paul in Kentucky, a thoughtful candidate who's right about most things, but, unfortunately, a squish on immigration. And sad to say, we won't have Alvin Green to kick around anymore. We're going to miss you, Alvin. Alvin?
The Mint started the recession.
Oh, shut up. Well, let's take a look at those election results. If there was a lesson from these midterms, it's a banal and familiar one that we nonetheless keep forgetting. The lesson is that nothing works like strong candidates. And conversely, nothing does you in like a weak candidate. One Sunday evening in 1777, James Boswell had an argument with Dr. Johnson about whether there is any skill or merit in acting. "Surely," said Boswell, "we should respect a great actor as a person who can conceive lofty sentiments and express them gracefully." Johnson: "What, sir? A fellow who claps a hump on his back and a lump on his leg and cries, 'I am Richard the Third.'" I disagree with Dr. Johnson there. There is such a thing as great acting. Not anybody can do it, and most of us would be unwise to try. Similarly, there are people who, however sound their views and however sincere their desire to serve, shouldn't go into politics. They just don't have the style, the gift, the knack, the je ne sais quoi. It's unfair, but there you are. It's unfair that Zhang Ziyi doesn't respond to my emails, but that's life. If I were to clap a hump on my back and say, "I am Richard the Third," people would just assume I was drunk. It's the same with politicking, which, let's face it, has a lot in common with acting. By custom and tradition, Americans have come to prefer a certain manner, a certain style, from our politicians. We want seriousness and good manners, a respectable resume, and a certain quality of ordinariness, of mediocrity even, of the ability to phrase whatever the guy wants to say in comfortable clichés with all the sharp, spiky bits smoothed down. We don't want any surprises. Some of this week's candidates violated those rules in obvious ways. Carl Palladino missed the seminar on manners. Christine O'Donnell's resume wasn't substantial enough to get her a job at Dunkin' Donuts. Tom Tancredo still has a few spiky bits in need of attention from the power sander. I did think Sharon Angle would be acceptable to the Nevada electorate, though, and her loss is really a big disappointment. And I must say, something of a bafflement to me. The first thing I always want to know about any election is how many people turned out to vote. The election pundits always tell you, oh, the American people decided this, or the American people have shown they want that. But what I always want to know is just how many of us they're talking about. Well, you don't really get big turnouts in midterm elections. Percentage-wise, it's high 30s to low 40s. Nationwide turnout this time seems to have been 42%, which is the high end of the range for midterms. It cuts differently by state, though. Utah had a low turnout, 33%, while next-door Nevada had a sensationally high one, 65%, nearly twice the Utah rate. It wasn't just the Reed angle factor in Nevada either. Nevada got 59% turnout at the last midterms in 2006. Nevadans just like voting. Perhaps pulling down a handle at the side of a machine just comes naturally to them. It cuts differently by other social factors too. Young voters and minority voters disproportionately stayed home on Tuesday. Older voters disproportionately turned out, and so on. The bottom line here is that the sort of political enthusiasm you get on websites like NRO isn't actually that widespread. Most people, at least 4 out of 7, don't bother to vote in midterms. Even in presidential elections, 3 out of 7 of us stay home. It's always salutary to remember that a great many Americans, perhaps a majority, go from one year's end to the next without ever thinking about politics. Most of them, I'm sure, live useful, healthy and productive lives. They pay taxes, fight in wars, raise their families and obey the law. They just don't care about politics. Quite a lot of the time, I find myself wishing I were among them. So let's go ahead and look at some results, but not without a nod to the 4 out of 7 Americans who thought the whole thing was a waste of time. Hey, they're Americans too. Which, given the level of corruption in the Democratic Party, is probably more than you can say for some of the people who did vote. Well, we got the House of Representatives. Nancy Pelosi's out, John Boehner's in. It could hardly help but be an improvement. But if you find John Boehner inspirational, all I can say is, you inspire easy. As I said, Americans like a certain quality of dull mediocrity in their politicians, but Boehner takes it much too far. His performance on Tuesday night, that whole lip-trembling act, turned my stomach. When I see a politician blubbing, it brings out the Don Corleone in me. You know, that scene in The Godfather, where Johnny Fontana breaks down and cries because he can't get a film part.
You can act like a man! What's the matter with you?
And all that whining from Boehner about how he'd had to do crappy jobs like bartending before he could get into heaven. Which is to say, Congress. You know the kinds of jobs he meant. the kind that us non-Congress critters have to do to make a living. Bartending? I was a bartender for a couple of years in Liverpool. It was pretty good work, and I liked it. I don't know what gives these Congress roaches the right to sneer at honest work. There's several million Americans right now who'd be glad of a job tending bar, or doing anything for an honest wage. I'd be happy to go back to bartending myself, if that's what I had to do to support my family. Well, here's John Boehner, 20 years warming a seat in the House of Representatives, 6 years on the House Education Committee, pushing through George W. Bush's No Child Left Behind Act, possibly the stupidest piece of legislation since Prohibition. That's the law mandating that by 2014, every child should be above average. The law that's turned education administration into a book-cooking art form. It's nice that leftist lunatics like Barney Frank no longer control the House. But with John Boehner in charge, I'm guessing that I'll need to have the phrase stupid party set up as a one-stroke keyboard macro. It's clearer than ever after Tuesday's results that the USA is two countries, Coastal Stan and Inlandia. At this point, we could pretty much rename the two big political parties. Instead of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, why not the Coastal Party and the Heartland Party? It would make more sense. New York and California both declined to ride the Republican wave. They didn't just decline, in fact, they reached back into the mythic past for Democratic governors. California elected Jerry Brown, who was governor 30 years ago, and the son of a previous governor. And New York elected Andrew Cuomo, who has not been governor before, in spite of having never strayed more than 100 yards from the state capitol in his entire adult life. And he is also the son of a previous governor. Both of these new governors sired by governors are left-wing Democrats. Both have states with humongous budget deficits. I should just add that the New York State Senate might yet tip Republican. They're still counting. This won't help our state, though. The New York State Republican Party is terminally dysfunctional, as witness their selection of the Rick Lazio robot, instead of listening to Radio Derb and going for Steve Levy. Lazio was so awful, GOP primary voters flocked to Carl Paladino from sheer revulsion, and the result followed. In the rest of the country, you have rhinos. We New Yorkers have rovelbs, Republicans of very little brain. There's some hopeful talk about Democrats being the best people to get in state-level office right now, as they can take an axe to public spending in a way that Republicans dare not. The Nixon to China principle. I don't believe a word of it. Brown and Cuomo are both stooges of the public sector unions. Neither of them is a Chris Christie. In fact, if you put the two of them together in one suit, you wouldn't even have a Chris Christie. These guys will just jack up taxes and inveigle the administration into shoveling more money into their decrepit, corrupt, worthless states. Then they'll issue some bogus bonds for the Treasury to buy and pass sanctuary laws to bring in even more Democrat voters. That last is, in fact, the heart of the matter. California and New York are both full of immigrants, legal and illegal. Because of our crazy rules on legal immigration, 2/3 of legal immigrants come in on family reunification visas, and this isn't restricted to spouses and dependent children as it should be. You've got elderly parents and unskilled siblings, and the elderly step-parents of step-siblings ad infinitum, all signing right on to the welfare rolls. illegal immigrants are mainly uneducated and unskilled, which is not a great recipe for living without public benefits in the modern USA. The demand for public services in these states is therefore huge and growing. If the state taxpayers can't pick up the tab, the heartland will have to. Some way will be found. The alternative would be to curtail both legal and illegal immigration, and that is utterly unthinkable. Why, if we did that, we'd be no better than Nazis. These coastal states are lost. If we ever get a conservative administration in Washington, they should just be sold off to countries that would manage them better. Somalia, perhaps, or North Korea. Having wandered into the national question there, let's take a look at the election's effect on that topic. If you're interested in the national question, that is, matters of immigration, citizenship, assimilation, and so on, there were some big pluses and some big minuses in the election results. First, the pluses. Lou Barletta, former mayor of Hazleton, Pennsylvania, got elected to the House from Pennsylvania's 11th District. Barletta was the mayor who, back in 2006, pushed through local ordinances against landlords renting to illegal immigrants, or businesses hiring them. Hazleton had become a centre for illegals, and they were destroying the town's quality of life. Usual suspects, the ACLU, La Raza, the Federal Justice Department, and all the rest, have stalled these ordinances in the courts, but Barletta took a good stand for American citizens there. Congratulations, Lou. The same to Jan Brewer, who scored an easy win in Arizona's gubernatorial, surely in part because of voters' anger at the federal government's arrogant determination to prevent Arizona acting against illegal immigration. The Arizona law in question, SB 1070, was originally sponsored by State Senator Russell Pierce, and Pierce was re-elected on Tuesday. And his party, the Republicans, increased their majority in the Arizona State Senate. For a trifecta here, Chris Kobach, the guy who drafted the Arizona law, was elected Secretary of State for Kansas. I've met Chris a couple of times, and I can tell the good people of Kansas, you couldn't have a smarter guy or a firmer patriot as your Secretary of State. Whatever it is the Secretary of State for Kansas does. Negotiate non-aggression treaties with Nebraska and Missouri, I suppose. Perhaps most hopeful of all, Iowa Representative Steve King will now chair the Immigration Subcommittee in the GOP-controlled House of Representatives. Representative King is strong on border security and on enforcement of immigration laws. Can you imagine a chairman of the House Immigration Subcommittee who favors enforcement of federal law? Amazing. Of course, Steve King will be up against John Boehner, who never saw a boat he wanted to rock, and who will lend a friendly ear to the cheap labor lobbies. But perhaps Steve can sneak stuff through when Boehner's off at the tanning salon. Heading up the bad news on the national question is Tom Tancredo's defeat at the hands of Denver Mayor John Hickenlooper in the Colorado gubernatorial. I wasn't that surprised. Colorado's generally classified with the rest of the Mountain West as don't tread on me libertarian. You know, people living wild on bear stew and wild honey. But in fact, the Centennial State contains huge numbers of loopy liberals. They won't let you in to Boulder if you're not sporting a ponytail, wearing Birkenstocks, and preferably riding a mountain bike. So, this isn't too surprising, but it's still a shame. The more so, as Tom was on a third-party ticket, polling well ahead of the GOP candidate, a bland establishment type. Establishment republicanism is never any more than a fair-weather friend to conservatives, so there's always a sneaky satisfaction in seeing them get a finger poked in their eye. And Tom at least did that. The other big disappointment here was Sharon Angle's defeat, which should keep Joy Behar gloating for a month. National Question enthusiasts will take what we can get, though, and we've gotten more from this election than we have from any election for a long time. The real pleasure of watching and reading about these election results has been seeing Liberals' heads explode. My favourite in this line was Tim Wise on the Daily Kos website. For those of you who don't know, Tim Wise bills himself as an anti-racist activist. He makes a living going around to colleges and companies, telling them how to purge themselves of racism. Tim Wise himself is a white guy, but he's quite vituperatively anti-white. He takes his cue from the late Susan Sontag, the lady who opined that, quote, "the white race is the cancer of human history." Well, here was Uncle Tim on the Daily Kos, venting about the election results. You really have to read the whole thing to get the full flavour, but here are some sample quotes. Bear in mind, please, that this is a guy who has made a career of preaching against hate. Bear in mind also that when a person like this is driven to insensate fury, a lot of four-letter words come out. There's nothing that says universal love, respect, and mutual understanding like a and a. I've avoided these taboo words as best I can and bleeped when I couldn't. OK, the heading of Tim's piece. An open letter to the white right on the occasion of your recent successful temper tantrum. Quote, "For all y'all rich folks, enjoy that champagne or whatever fancy scotch you drink. And for y'all a bit lower on the economic scale, enjoy your Pabst Blue Ribbon or whatever beer you favour." You see, Tim makes no distinctions of class. He hates all white people, rich and poor alike. The champagne-swilling wasp and the stump-toothed hillbilly, they're all the same to Tim. He's an equal opportunity white hater. Quote, "Party while you can, but mind the increasingly loud clock ticking away in the corners of your consciousness, the clock that reminds you how little time you and yours have left." I guess what Tim is telling us there is, in the words of a much greater thinker and writer, that we are doomed. Quote, "I know you think you've taken your country back with this election, and of course you have always thought it was yours for the taking, 'cause that's what we white folks are bred to believe, that it's ours, and how dare anyone else say otherwise. But you are wrong." So, who does the country belong to, Tim? Quote, "In about 40 years, half the country will be black or brown, and there is nothing you can do about it." Well, nothing at all. It's just like the wind and the tides, just a force of nature. Quote, "In 40 years or so, maybe fewer, there won't be any more white people around who actually remember that leave it to beaver, father knows best, Opie Taylor down at the fishing hole, corn pone bull that you hold so near and dear to your heart." Well, yeah, those 50s sitcoms were pretty good shows. You mean it was wrong of us to like them? Come on. After all, we didn't have any Joy Behar or Keith Olbermann to watch, so what were we supposed to do? Quote, "Do you hear it? The sound of your empire dying? Your nation as you knew it ending permanently? Because I do, and the sound of its demise is beautiful." Oh, boy. You know, listeners, I have occasionally used the word ethnomasochism in this kind of context, and I've had people email in to ask me what I mean by it. Well, go to Daily Kos and read Tim Weiss's piece. Then try to tell me that you don't know what ethnomasochism means. The weekend before the election, there was a strange sort of rally in our nation's capital, staged by John Stewart and Stephen Colbert. What was it all about? Beats me. It was called Rally to Restore Sanity. The main idea seems to be that if you disagree with John Stewart and Stephen Colbert and the smug liberals who watch their shows, then you are insane. What else does it mean? If John and Steve need to restore sanity, when did they think sanity was lost? 2 years ago, when we elected Barack Obama and a Democratic Congress? Good grief, no. Sanity was lost when the Tea Party movement came up. Sanity was lost when Obama started sliding in the polls. Sanity was lost when Arizona voted to assist enforcing federal law. Sanity was lost when it looked as though Republicans would win big in this week's elections. To restore sanity, you have to vote for liberals, Democrats and rhinos, just as all sane people do, just as John and Stephen and all their smirking, tittering followers do. If you're a Stuart Colbert fan, sanity is what you read on the op-ed pages of the New York Times or hear on National Public Radio. Sanity is what you hear from Rachel Maddow and Katie Couric. Everything else is insanity. Well, I'll confess I didn't watch the Rally to Restore Sanity in real time. I just viewed a few clips on YouTube after the event. It all looked pretty lame. John and Stephen were speaking their lines from memorized scripts in a way that left me more than ever convinced that Dr. Johnson was wrong about actors. Neither of them was much used to moving around on stage. Both looked as if they were terrified they might break a nail or get their hair mussed. So far as the Rally to Restore Sanity had any discernible theme, it was the elites mocking the great unwashed. Here are the moosed, designer-clad, wine-of-the-month-club, bottled water and Birkenstocks, oh, so ironic, lords of the realm, sneering at us peasants. I don't think they want to hustle us into gas chambers, the way Tim Wise obviously does. After all, with no one to sneer at, these guys would be out of a job. They just want their supporters to know how right they all are to detest us. The rallyers' pretensions of moral superiority unfortunately suffered a mild setback when a photograph of the crowd went circulating round the internet. The photograph, which was taken looking down from some platform or tower, showed the faces of 400 people, of whom just 5 were black. That's a tad more than 1%. The average Tea Party rally is blacker than that, yet the Tea Partiers are denounced as racist, while the Stuart Colbert rally was infused with the purest, most high-minded liberal universalism. You see, our liberal elites are not just smug liars, they are smug lying hypocrites. But you knew that. The briefest of brief miscellanies this week, boys and girls, as I am over my time allowance. Let's just take a glance at the non-election news. Item, as noted by Radio Derb last week, the president is off to India this weekend, apparently taking most of the federal government with him. Good riddance, I say. Though, of course, there's not much hope they'll stay there. Estimates of the expenses for the trip run up to $200 million a day, which would be more than the cost of the war in Afghanistan. The White House has poo-pooed that number, saying that the president's trip will cost nothing like that. Probably not even as much as the Korean War. Item, the oldest person in the world has died. Eugenie Blanchard, a native of St. Bart's in the Caribbean. 114 years old. Eugenia was born in the second Grover-Cleveland administration. That Caribbean climate will do wonders for you. That and a very quiet life. Miss Blanchard was a nun who never married and had no kids. The new oldest person, Eunice Sanborn of Louisiana, who was also born in 1896. Item, Radio Derb would like to make it clear that we have no connection with Thomas Derbyshire, the financial adviser currently being sued in a Manhattan court by Prince Geoffrey Bolkiah of Brunei. The prince claims that his advisers diddled him out of $7 million in the sale of his house here on Long Island. It's not clear to me why the prince is bothering with this lawsuit. He's infinitely rich. His brother, the Sultan of Brunei, who's even richer, once accused the prince of embezzling $15 billion. $15 billion. So $7 million is just dinner and a movie to this guy. The house in question has 23 bedrooms, and it needed them when Prince Geoffrey owned the place, as he is quite the ladies' man. 17 children by 7 women, and a major customer of the kind of outfit that got Elliot Spitzer in so much trouble. What's got everyone's attention is the claim by the defending attorney that the house also contains 6 life-size bronze statues of the prince engaged in Congress with a lady. The prince is trying to get photographs of the statues excluded from the court case. I note that Prince Geoffrey is a Muslim. A Muslim who could give Charlie Sheen a run for his money. CARE should hire him as an image consultant. Item, today, Friday, is November 5th, when English people celebrate the foiling of Guy Fawkes' gunpowder plot. Back in AD 1605, Guy and his fellow conspirators stashed 36 barrels of gunpowder below the Houses of Parliament in order to blow up the King and his ministers. The only honest man that ever got into Parliament, according to my dad. It was an attempt at what we nowadays call terrorism. Truly, there is nothing new under the sun. Remember, remember the 5th of November, gunpowder, treason, and plot. There we are, listeners, a tumultuous week in politics, and let us hope a turn for the better in our national affairs. I'm still upset about Sharon Angle and Tom Tancredo, though. What's the matter with those people out there in Colorado and Nevada? Such good candidates. It's really very upsetting. I don't know what I'm going to do.
You can act like a man! What's the matter with you?
Oh, right. Sorry. Thanks, Godfather. To see us out, here's the president addressing all those people who voted for Hope and Change 2 years ago.
You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips. There's no tenderness like before in your fingertips. You're trying hard not to show it.